Oh, I like this, a religious silence, it's wonderful. Good evening to this congregation then. My name is Paul Holden-Graber and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, otherwise known as Live from the New York Public Library. I'm sorry I've repeated this so many times, but I simply cannot avoid saying it one more time. My role at the library is simply to make the lions roar. I was brought here by the president of this library to oxygenate this building, and when we came into New York about 500 days ago, the first sign I saw was ozone alert, so I knew my services were needed. It's a great pleasure to welcome you tonight to another Wired evening. Five Wired evenings, and I hope we'll do at least another 10. Back in Los Angeles, where I lived before blissfully in Santa Monica, I had the pleasure of bringing David Byrne, who spoke about why he loved PowerPoint, and half of Silicon Valley came out to see David Byrne talk about why he loved PowerPoint, and maybe even believed that he did love PowerPoint, which was quite amusing. We had Jeff Tweedy and Lawrence Lessig, who's here tonight, with Stephen Johnson, which was a wonderful evening called Who Owns Culture? Then we did a wonderfully smackdown, I think was the word used, contentious evening, much in the spirit of what I hope this evening will be. We'll talk about that in a minute. We did an event on Google, you know, the digitization of libraries and all the issues surrounding that. And some of the people who I think now are suing each other were on stage together, which I thought was particularly wonderful. Especially the reception afterwards where they didn't talk to each other. And then we had Cameron Sinclair last week here talking about sustainable architecture with John Hockenberry. And tonight we have an event with Chris Anderson talking about his ever-growing long tail. This evening, what Chris Anderson will do is he'll give you a presentation, a short presentation, he tells me, which will be anywhere from 12 to 45, no, 15 minutes long, he said, followed by a conversation with Lawrence Lessig, and then there will be a Q&A period. I ask you to, during that period, the Q&A period, to remember the word question rather than statement. In my experience of doing this for a decade, I've made a study, a quite scientific study at that, and I realized that question can be asked in this kind of a setting in about 51 seconds or so. So if you're called upon to speak for 3 minutes, just try to make it shorter. You know, there's an old saying from Pascal who said, if I had had more time, I would have made it shorter, so do try. I would also like to promote a free event that is going to happen tomorrow, unlike ours, which are, you know, deadly expensive. I would like to promote this event that Wired Magazine and NextFest is putting on tomorrow morning. It's Television in the Age of Web Video. And the featured speakers, I'm told they're very famous, is Billy Campbell, Jennifer Fiken, Larry Kramer, Judy McGrath, and Jeff Zucker, and one person I recognize on that list, Chris Anderson. So I highly recommend you go to that. It is at 8 a.m. My goodness, you won't sleep very much tonight. At 8 a.m. and it's at the Javits Center, which is at 11th Avenue between West 34th and 39th Street. So it must be a rather big building. As you saw, tonight's event is called The Rise and Fall of the Blockbuster, and I don't know how many of you know the origin of the word blockbuster, but it's quite interesting. It comes from the Second World War, where one actually busted blocks. Obviously, the meaning has changed slightly, and I'm always amused by the tension between the notion of blockbuster and something that bombs. I encourage you all to join our email list so that you may find out the events we're doing in the near future and in the far future. For anybody who joins today the email list, you will get 2 free tickets for the remaining part of our season. I think we have another 30 events coming up. We have 4 this week. Tomorrow I will be interviewing Frank Rich, and the day after, Robert Frank and Howard Norman will be here, and after that we will have Carl Bernstein, Adam Gopnik, who I also will be interviewing, David Rockwell with John Hockenberry, and many, many more other people coming. I encourage you to come to these live events, Jan Morris, Andy Borowitz, etc. Tonight, the biggest challenge, I think, is really the challenge I have put forward to Chris Anderson and Lawrence Lessig. They know each other fairly well, and I've asked them to goad each other as much as possible and to really offer us a vigorous and rigorous and perhaps, why not, playful, but always sustained debate on issues pertaining to the ever-growing long tail. It's with pleasure now that I introduce to you Chris Anderson, who will then, I imagine, introduce Lawrence Lessig. Thank you very much.
Good evening. I may wander. I appear to be over-mic'd here. Thank you, Paul, for the generous and introduction and for reminding us of the theme, the rise and fall of the blockbuster. What I'd like to talk to you about is hits and bestsellers and blockbusters. And I'd like to suggest that we've seen it all wrong, that the world that I've grown in up in, the world that most of us have grown up in, the world of hits, the world of top 40 radio and Hollywood domination of culture, is not just about to end, but was an anomaly, not the norm. Before the 20th century, the 19th century and earlier, we didn't have this culture. We had a fragmented culture. It was a culture fragmented by geography. We had one town would do one thing and another town would do another, and culture moved at the pace of people. Traveling troubadour groups, for instance. And what you found is that you had folk culture, of course, and we were a balkanized culture, we were fragmented culture, and it was entirely based on distance. And then, at the end of the 19th century and beyond, we had the rise of technologies that changed the game. First, you had high-speed printing, that went from sort of the potential for the printed word to get everywhere to national newspapers and beyond. We had the rise of photographic technology that took this extraordinary thing of the image and was able to reproduce it so that many people could see it. You had recording technology, which turned music from a performance art into a product that could be bought and sold and copied and distributed many, many times. And then in the 1930s, you had the rise of the most powerful of these technologies of all, radio and broadcast. And what radio did, the physics and economics of radio, are powerful drivers of a very different form of distribution. It's the one-to-many, where a small number of things get broadcast out to many millions of people simultaneously. And in a moment, we suddenly snapped culture into cultural lockstep. We synchronized as a nation, as communities, and eventually as a world, because of the power of broadcast to reach everybody simultaneously with a small number of cultural products. And then in the 1950s, this became true for the very powerful visual image, television as well, and that is the world that we've grown up in, the world dominated by the physics and economics of broadcast distribution that preferentially get a small number of blockbusters, hits, primetime bestsellers to everybody simultaneously. And what I'd like to argue is that that era has peaked, and I believe that era peaked on this day. March 21st, 2000. It's the first day of spring of a new century. It was 5 days after the NASDAQ bust, and it was the release of NSYNC's second album, No Strings Attached. Every year, in the years leading up to this, some album would set a record as the bestseller. This album, once again, set a record. It sold 1 million copies in the first day and 2.41 million copies in the first week. And history would have remembered it only for a few months until the next year's album, once again, set a new record, except for history will remember this album differently because this record was never broken and may never be broken. This is what's happened to hit albums in the years since then. The music industry as a whole, measured by revenues, has been largely flat in the last 5 years. The CD sales are down, but digital sales, measured things like iTunes downloads and even ringtones, has largely made up the difference. But the hits, the bestsellers, the gold, platinum, multi-platinum, diamond albums have fallen by more than 50%. Something radically different is happening in music. Now, what's interesting is that over this period, more music than ever was being made. There's 65,000 albums released every year. And more music than ever is being consumed, thanks to the extraordinary ability to take music out of the living room and into every walk of life. Thank you, Apple, iPod, and digital and the MP3. So there's more supply, there's more demand, there's more music culture, but the hits are losing share. The hits as the dominant voice of music, the hits as the way we see music culture, is diminishing radically as the audience fragments. Once again, the audience is huge and listening to music, but they're not listening to the same things at the same time. We have once again distributed, but now not this time by geography, but we're distributing by taste. We're going to find the music that we want to listen to, the niches, the minority tastes of music. And what's powerful about this is that what we're finding is that there is a lot of life outside the top 40. There is life beyond the blockbuster. And in a sense, we've been seeing the world through the wrong end of the telescope. You know, if you look at the wrong end of the telescope, you see a very, very tiny, concentrated image. And what you're finding is you turn the telescope around and you see. Actually, I'm going to reverse my metaphor. You then switch to a fisheye lens. Thank you, optics. And we're finally seeing there's a huge world out there, far beyond top 40 radio, far beyond the shelf. And it's not just music. This is, forgive me, I've skipped a slide. We're finding that in television, as we get more and more choice, as we've gone from analog 4-channel, 5-channel terrestrial broadcast to analog cable with 40 channels, to digital cables with 100 channel, to then even high capacity digital cable with 400 channels, that the market share of the networks and the hits has been shrinking. And last month, an all-time record low for network market share. Once again, people are watching as much television as ever, but they're watching different television at different time. You can see it on the individual show level. Here it is. Here is the number one show in each year. In the 1950s, extraordinarily, 70% of American homes were watching the same show at the same time, I Love Lucy. This is the peak of the water cooler era. And you could come into work the next morning and be pretty sure that everyone in your office had done the same thing you had the previous night. Walter Cronkite, the news, I Love Lucy. I may have my arrows slightly off there, but you get the point. And then over time, as there are more and more choices, as there were more and more shows, more and more channels, and then eventually as we learned to time shift, first with the VCR and now with TiVo, we're not watching the same thing at the same time. And today, CSI, the number one show, wouldn't have made the top 10 just 15 years ago. We're once again fragmenting. We're distributing across the spectrum of culture because powerful distribution channels with more choice and variety allow us to do so. Radio, as I mentioned, was the major driver of music culture for most of my childhood. And today, we're finding that music radio is in apparently terminal decline. Last year, one top 40 radio station per week went out of business or changed format to talk or Latin or some other form of radio because they cannot find a playlist so perfectly constructed by some awesome DJ that it can suit everybody all the time. We have iPods, we have CD players, we have satellite radio, and we have the cell phone. They're all now in competition with what was once the most powerful force in music culture, top 40 radio. Once again, this is newspapers. My slides are clearly out of order. And you're finding this sort of secular decline over the last, over now multi-decades as you have more and more choice in media. You don't have to settle for one publication that does it all. And even Hollywood, you know, the last bastion of the blockbuster is now appearing to go soft. Here you have movie tickets sold over the last, since 2002. And what you find is that you know, we heard a lot about Pirates of the Caribbean 2, which set an all-time box office record. But even with Pirates of the Caribbean 2, we're still down almost 10% from 2004. And were it not for Pirates of the Caribbean 2, we'd be down by more than 15%. So even Hollywood seems to be slightly losing its power to command the attention of everybody simultaneously. So where are they all going? Where is everybody going? This is the long tail. And that shape is a shape that I'll be talking a little bit more about. I think it is the shape of the 21st century. It's called a power law. And a couple things to note about that shape, that curve, that sort of ski slope that starts really high on the left and falls off into this long bunny slope off to the right. That is also known as Pareto's curve. It is the origins of the 80-20 rule. Wilfred Pareto, the Italian economist, noted that wealth was unevenly distributed in Italy, that 20% of the people had 80% of the wealth. And that 80-20 rule we see all around us, and it is exactly the shape of the curve, which is to say that some things sell a lot and represent the lion's share of the attention or the popularity or the money in any market, and then there's everything else. Now, the red part on this curve represents what we do, what we've done for the last 100 years with the Pareto curve. What we've done is we've hacked it off. We've savagely truncated the curve because of what? Because of limits. We have limited shelf space. We have limited screens. We have limited channels. We have limited radio stations. We have scarcity. We have limits to distribution. Distribution costs money. And if you only have so much shelf space, you're going to be very discriminating about what gets on it. You know, the rent on a half inch of shelf space, something like $2 per year, you need something that's going to make good use of that shelf space. You need something that's going to be popular, that's going to have high turns, so that it pays back that expense of distribution. That's why we are very discriminating about what gets on the airways. We're very discriminating about what gets in the theaters, because distribution is expensive. And so we've seen the world through just the red. That's just the blockbusters. That's where we cut the curve off. But now we have the rise of these new markets. Over the last 10 years, we've seen, you know, starting with Amazon and then eBay and iTunes and Netflix and eventually Google and the blogosphere, we have these new markets that have infinite shelf space. Their cost of distribution is close to zero, and they don't have to discriminate. And now, for the first time in history, we can see the whole curve. We can switch from our telescope to our fisheye lens. And what we're finding is that it keeps going. It keeps going potentially forever. And that in aggregate, the long tail of onesies and twosies, those long tail of niche products, of minority tastes that aren't mass market appeal, there are so many of them that they can add up to a big new market. And this big new market has a very different dynamic. I want to show you just in the last few slides some actual data. This is Rhapsody. It's a music service. It's a subscription service, a little bit like iTunes. And you probably remember the music stores of 10 years ago or 20 years ago. These were stores that had maybe a whole wall of import albums, that maybe there'd be a room in the back with glassed in that was the jazz or the classical section, had great speakers and perfect acoustics, and the staff would be able to tell you what they were into. I don't know how many of you have been to a Walmart recently, but Walmart is today America's largest CD retailer. The music section in Walmart is 4,200 albums on average. It's pop, it's R&B, and then easy listening. Classical is represented by 6 or 8 albums under easy listening. Jazz is often under easy listening. All of world music is there under easy listening. It is a soul-destroying experience. It is, however, the way America sees, the way most of America sees music. Give you another point of reference, 65,000 albums released every year in America, 700 of them make it into Walmart. So if you look at it in the charts, so those 4,200 albums, if you convert them into individual tracks and measure the ones that actually sell, that works out to be about 25,000 tracks. So that's where the number one retailer in America hacks off the curve. But of course, online, they're all available. Rhapsody today, I've cut this off for scale reasons at 900,000 tracks, but Rhapsody today offers 1.5 million. iTunes offers about 2 million. The peer-to-peer networks like Kazaa, the file trading networks, offer about 9 million. If you talk to people about what's out there in vinyl, in live shows, in remixes, in versions, there's probably about 25 million tracks at least out there that will be coming online. And so when you contrast it, you see the long tail of music is so long. So what does it add up to in total? Well, this somewhat complicated chart gives you an example of that. What I have over here is in the scale is the difference in inventory. So the red part represents the inventory of the largest retailer in the land. And the yellow part represents the inventory in these new long tail markets. And of course, what you see is that it's orders of magnitude more variety and choice and diversity out there in these markets that are where the distribution costs are close to zero. Now, if you measure in terms of the total sales, you know, of course, the remember that power law curve, that Pareto curve? Yes, some products sell much, much more than others. So even though the 25,000 tracks is a tiny fraction of the available music out there, it represents the lion's share of the total sales, even on a digital market like Rhapsody. So that 25,000 tracks represents about 60% of Rhapsody's sales. But what's interesting is that everything else represents 40%. That's nearly half of the market is music not available in the largest retailer in the land. Now, this is a really big deal, because we've assumed that you know, what made it onto the shelf, what was good, and what we wanted. We now realize just what a false assumption that is, that the vast majority of everything doesn't get out there through traditional retail channels. And what we assumed that, of course, it was de minimis, it was sub-economic, it wasn't worth considering, it just didn't pass the economic test for distribution. And what we're finding is that in aggregate, we're talking about half the market. So half the market, and by the way, this is the fastest growing part of the market, and within 5 years it really will be half the market online. What we're finding is that we'd missed half the market. The fastest growing, most dynamic, most exciting part of the market was the stuff that didn't make it out before, and now it does. The same is true for DVDs. Netflix is probably no DVD rental service. Blockbuster has about 4,000 unique DVDs. Netflix has about 65,000. Blockbuster, as befits its name, has the blockbusters. But Netflix finds that about 20 more than, coming up on a quarter of the market is now of their usage, of their traffic, of their business, is DVDs not available in Blockbuster, the largest retailer in the land, and even books. If you go into a Barnes & Noble or Borders, there are superstores. There are huge increase in variety over the smaller stores that preceded them, 100,000 books. And yet there's 3.7 million books in print. There's maybe 70 million books if you include those books that are out of print. Even 100,000 books represents a tiny, tiny fraction of the actual choice that's out there if you can only distribute it efficiently. Obviously, Amazon is such an efficient distributor, and you find that Amazon's finding that about a quarter of its book sales are books beyond the top 100,000, are books not available in the largest retailer in the land. That's the long tail. So I wanted to end with just a couple lessons and then a little video, but as I say, we've grown up in the era of hit-driven culture, and we've assumed that's what we want. And what we're finding is that there's certain fallacies, there's certain assumptions you make about culture that are based on this experience, and they may not be right. So Barry Diller is perhaps the greatest genius in our traditional entertainment industry today. He's a guy who has his finger on the pulse of what we want. And this was a quote he gave at a conference that was at last year. People with talent won't be displaced by 18 million people producing stuff they think will have appeal. This is very much mainstream blockbuster thinking. Nods throughout the audience as he said that. This is YouTube. This is the most popular videos on YouTube. As you know, YouTube is user-generated, user-created, user-submitted videos, you know, ranging from, you know, grandma got hit with a brick, to cat videos, to fantastic animations. And today, YouTube is streaming 100 million videos per day, 65,000 videos being uploaded to YouTube every day. YouTube now has an audience around the size of one of the big four television networks. And it's all created by individuals, by people like you, by amateurs. Is there ever been a better example of exactly what Barry Diller said couldn't happen? 18 million people producing stuff they think will have appeal. And just going to go back, it's not just YouTube. MySpace is the same thing happening in music. Flickr is the same thing happening in photography. The blogosphere is the same thing happening in media. And Wikipedia is the same thing happening in encyclopedias. This is exactly what the blockbuster mainstream hit machine thought couldn't happen, and it's exactly what's happening right now. So there's five fallacies that we should unlearn. The first is that we've confused limited distribution with shared taste. We thought we wanted hits. What we're finding is that distribution channels want hits. Blockbusters make the best, most efficient use of limited distribution. What we want is choice. We want variety, we want more, and now we can have it. We assumed that we were mainstream, or most of us were mainstream. What we're finding is that each one of us deviates from the mainstream in some part of our life. You could be mainstream music, books, DVDs, and if you're into parachuting, you will find that, you know, your interests are not well represented on the shelves of Walmart, but they are now represented online, and that niche is available, and you want to go as deep as it can go. I was just learning about the parachuting industry. There's 35,000 members of the American Parachuting Association. There are hundreds of books targeted for them. That every niche goes as deep as is humanly possible, and it's all now available to you. We've, of course, assumed that one size fits all was a safe assumption. You know, let's go for the product that touches on our shared interests. And now we're realizing we don't have to do that. In fact, you know, one size fits one makes people happier. To not have to treat people in lumps, not have to clump them together into sort of grossly aggregated, you know, amalgamations of shared interests, and instead reflect minority interests, reflect individual interests, treat people as individuals rather than big, coarse, granular markets or non-granular markets. This is now what's possible. One of the biggest fallacies is the assumption that the good stuff was the stuff that was out there and that everything else is crap. What we're finding, of course, is the long tail full of crap? Absolutely. And it's also full of extraordinary works of genius and inspiration. What you're finding out is that the stuff at the head is the stuff of broad interest, and the stuff at the tail is of narrow interest. And sometimes the most refined, brilliant works in any area are the stuff of narrow interest. If you're into Greek history, the most scholarly, authoritative book, 3 volumes, 800 pages, whatever, of Greek history will not be a bestseller. But it is perhaps the best book on Greek history, and you can now reach it. Now, the worst book on Greek history is also down there in the tail, which means that it's very important to have fantastic filters, Google recommendations, etc., to find the diamonds in the rough, to pick the, you know, to find those gems that suit your interests. But what's interesting about it is that there's no one definition of quality. It's not like we can sort of find the good bits and suppress the bad. Your good bits are not my good bits. Each one of us has different tastes, and we define quality our own way. And increasingly, with filters that are driven, like Google, by individual taste, we can find the bits that are just right for us. This was never possible before. And finally, we're recognizing that the mass market is becoming a mass of niches. So small is the new big, and many is the new few. And this is a video that my friend Peter Hirschberg made to make it all seem clear.
No one would have believed in the closing years of the 20th century that our most popular media were being watched in a new way by a force that was quietly gathering strength. With blind confidence, we considered them our own, our audience, our subscribers, our cuddly couch potatoes. With infinite complacency, we wisely sold them to advertisers. We learned to shape their habits, mold their desires, and give them the illusion of infinite choice. Yet from their side of the screen, with envious eyes, they studied us. And bit by bit, they learned and linked and drew their plans against us, wielding weapons we ourselves provided. And then, early in the 21st century, came the great unraveling. We offered free choice, but all they heard was free. We devised more powerful, more complete, more feature-rich software. But they preferred to grow their own. They pounced, and they blogged, and they blew the house down. The world we knew was forever disintermediated, whatever that means. They have tasted power, and there are a lot more of them than there are of us. High inside our glass towers, our greatest minds prepare to respond.
Can't we just start blogging back at them?
Well, yeah, but where's the money in that?
Thank you. Now I'd like to welcome Larry Lessig, Stanford professor.
Thank you. Yeah.
Also Wired columnist and founder and leader of the Creative Commons
right.
project.
So the important thing not to focus on is that Chris is my boss. The real reason I'm here is, so Chris, this is your first book, right?
My first book.
Yeah, and bestseller.
As it happens.
Right, so I write books for a living, but my books actually live in the long tail, Chris, unlike yours. I know something about this long tail.
I can live with the irony that my book on niches has become a bestseller.
Yeah, well, let that curse fall on all of us. So let's start with some boring things, and then we can make it more interesting. And boring, talk a little bit about the numbers. So there have been a lot of people, and I don't think this is a significant criticism, but a lot of people who say, whoa, the numbers are not quite as exciting as you set them out. And there are two ways to think about why the numbers might not be as exciting. One is that the hits are not really taking a hit as much as you say. And the other is that the long tail is not really as big as you want to say. So David Pakman at eMusic says iTunes is a bad example. 90% of their revenue comes from 10% of their stuff. The Wall Street Journal, Lee Gomes, point about the extent to which the new numbers suggest 90-10 is the new rule, not 98%. You seem to want to fight that argument a lot, and I don't get why you do. I mean, why not just, why isn't the real point that there's this huge new market, not that hits are not so important anymore?
Actually, I mean, it's a fair point. I've never argued that hits were dead or that hits weren't important. As a matter of fact, you know, the long tail is the very same, you know, Pareto curve of radical inequality that, you know, we've had all along. My point is that the long tail is reflects the same hit dominance. However, the big difference is that the monopoly of the hit is over. The difference between the old market, which was that, you know, some things sold a lot better than others, and only those things made it to market, is that now everything makes it to market, and the hits now have to compete with a million niches. So hits are not dead. As a matter of fact, it's even more than that. What you're finding is that there will probably be more hits than ever. The old model of hits was that hits had to come through the hit-making machine. So, you know, I needed to get signed by a big publisher, you needed to get your, you know, signed to a label, you needed to get your foot in the door in Hollywood, the television industry, to even get out into the marketplace. And so the hits were identified by the tastemakers in power, were then crafted by the tastemakers in power, and then promoted with these extraordinary marketing machines. And some of these hits were fantastic products that deserved every bit of celebrity, and some of them are what I call synthetic hits, which are basically hits created by a machine that requires hits. Garfield 2 comes to mind. And that was the only way to get to market. The new way is that anybody can get to market. So the tools of production and distribution are entirely democratized. And so now you see, rather than the top-down, you know, commercial hits, you see the rise of the bottoms-up grassroots hits. So these YouTube viral videos that have, you know, the OK Go music video, which you may have seen, these are the new hits. They are every bit as popular as the old hits, but they're coming to market in an entirely different way. So they're being identified by the sort of meritocracy of public opinion rather than the guesswork and taste of a few select tastemakers.
So it's that they lose control and the ability to create the hits. So the NSYNC example that you gave here, which was the last, as you describe it in the book, crafted hits, yeah. And the artists actually had nothing to do with creating the underlying composition that was the art, something like 34?
No, there were 57 contributors to that album.
Right. So this sort of molded hit is what we're losing, and there'll be new hits that won't be molded in that way.
Well, they'll continue to try, but they're going to lose power. And we've done some interesting work. We've been measuring, measuring the power of word of mouth. So word of mouth can create a new hit by sort of, you know, this viral video is exactly word of mouth. Word of mouth can also quickly kill a synthetic hit that doesn't deserve hit status. So the way we measure this is in terms of the second weekend fall off of Hollywood. So the old model is that, you know, you go for a big opening weekend, and then, you know, then the reviews come in, and you try to get 6 weeks, 8 weeks, a sort of gradual decline. What you're finding is that because word of mouth spreads so quickly, that if it doesn't deserve its hit status, that people will find out about instantaneously. And we're now seeing the second week decline in Hollywood has gone from 35% to 46% in just the last 10 years. So, you know, they're just plummeting. You know, the ones that don't deserve celebrity status are plummeting out of the box office much more quickly because we now have the capacity to measure popularity, not based on what certain reviewers say or what marketing and advertising messages say, but what we think.
Let's think about the other side, the tail. So in this little exchange about how significant the tail was, I think Nick Carr made a nice point, which is the real issue that we got to think about is how much has the internet actually increased the market there and complemented what used to be old markets. But you don't really have a lot of data to sort of get a good sense of what's caused by this new long tail. One data point you put forward is in publication. You talk about at the time Amazon was born, it was about 1.5 million books in print, and now it's 3.7 that they are able to carry on their title. Do you think that growth from 1.5 to 3.7 is because of this phenomenon?
You know, it's interesting. Last year there were 175,000 new books published. The year before, as it happens, there were 190,000 new books. You know, it's now the power to publish a book is now in everybody's hands. You can actually, you know, self-publishing, which used to be considered a sort of an undignified way of vanity publishing, is now quite a good. It's sort of the blogging of books, as it were. Lulu and other services allows you to do this. So, you know, there are more books out there because it's easier and easier to get a book out there. I wanted to talk a little bit about the size of the tail because you brought that up. It's actually a statistical mistake. The problem is that we're used to thinking in terms of percentages. 80-20 rule is, in fact, percentages. And the problem is that when the marketplace is finite, that's perfectly reasonable. If you have 100 products, 80-20 is a good thing. If the marketplace is infinite, you end up with the denominator blowing up to going to infinity, and the percentages don't work anymore. So what I do, I try to be quite careful about my definitions, that the head, as I define it, is measured by the products available in the largest bricks and mortar retailer in that space. And the tail is everything else. So this is an absolute number. In the case of music, it was 25,000 tracks. It was in videos, it was 4,000. In books, it was 100,000. It's an absolute number. And the tail is everything else. The problem is if you do it in percentage terms. So let's say that that the top 100 albums.
Yeah, remember, I'm a lawyer, so you gotta be slow on these things.
So. Okay. So let's say,
see, because I'm willing to take this structure. So all we're talking about is absolute numbers.
Yeah. Because the denominator grows up to infinite, what you find is that it statistically makes the head look smaller. So now 1% of the market represents 90% of those sales. But if that 1% now represents the top 10,000 rather than the top 100, it's actually a much more distributed market. But
right.
Percentages don't tell the story.
But what Nick Carr was saying didn't quibble with you about this way of thinking about it. He was saying, you take, for example, in the context of books, the largest distributor has 100,000 books, and then everything else is the long tail, and that's Amazon's 3.7 million. So 2.7 is in the head, percent is in the head, but when your absolute number, everything else is in the tail. The question he asks is, how much has that market grown because of the phenomenon of the tail, as opposed to other distributions that existed before? Because, of course, not everybody bought books at Barnes & Noble. Right. There were specialty bookstores. There were all sorts of different ways of distributing books. So has there been a real change because of the phenomenon of the digital distribution?
So what you're saying is that as we can now access the tail, and as we can now measure the increased demand for minority taste products, is that increasing the production of minority taste products?
Yes.
I think the answer is the blogosphere is probably a pretty good example of that. The blogosphere is the long tail of media, right? So I'm a magazine editor, and I used to compete with other magazine editors and newspapers. I now compete with 27 million blogs. Those blogs exist partly because people have something to say, and partly because they're being read. This is a rivalrous medium. If they're reading a blog, they're not reading me, or at least at that particular moment. So I think that the fact that the audience has shifted down the tail is definitely creating more blogs in the tail.
Okay, so blogs is an easy one because we know in 1992 there were no blogs,
right.
And now there are lots of them. But a bunch of books, you're saying, a significant chunk of the difference between 1.5 and 3.7 is because of this new ability easily to get access to the tail.
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, book writing is a weird business. So the average book sells 500 copies a year.
So we think people write books to become to make money. We think they write books to become best-selling authors. They clearly don't, since 99.999% of them will fail. They will by that standard. They won't become bestsellers and they won't make money. So why do they write books? And you know, I mean, people write books because...
Yeah, I know.
As an academic, people write books because they have something to say. They have write books to get tenure. They write books because they want to sell their consultancy. Some of them write books because they want to have a cultural change. People write books for largely non-economic reasons. And the question is, if they write books to be read, then I would have thought that absolutely yes, that those books now, because they're available, aren't getting bigger readership. Maybe it's gone from, you know, an author and his immediate family to his author and his extended family, but it still is a growing audience.
Okay, so this book has a lot in it beyond just the stuff that you've just given us here. Some of the most interesting parts are the discussion of this new cultural phenomenon of cooperative sharing production. So you're obsessed with, rightfully so, Wikipedia, yeah. Which is the latest version. The early, you know, 5 years ago, we would have been obsessed with free software or open source software. But I have a feel sometimes when I'm reading it that this is a phenomenon of, if you've only got a hammer, then a hammer is the tool you use to understand everything. And I have a little bit of skepticism whether the long tail really helps us understand all of this. So I want to introduce a distinction. And I need a movie to do it, so I'm going to do a little movie show here. And then I want to talk about the long tail as it relates to that distinction. So let's see if we can do this little show. I think it's... Okay, so the distinction I want to talk about is the distinction between read-only and read-write culture. Okay, so read-only culture is this new massively efficient technology to enable people at any time and anywhere to buy and consume culture produced elsewhere. So the poster child of this vision in your discussion is Apple, right? Their wonderful iTunes music store, 99 cents to buy any song you want. Download it to your iPod and only to your iPod, very important thing, but you're guaranteed that if you do that in our culture, you'll be called cool. And it's not just music that they do this with, videos, and not just Apple. You talk about all of these companies in the business of making it really easy to increasingly perfect this market for getting access to our culture, right? That's read-only. Very different new phenomenon out there I want to call read-write. And that's being driven by companies like these, companies that are not so much interested in people consuming, or not just consuming, they're also interested in people creating and sharing their creativity, right? So some examples to liven this up a bit, right? So anime music videos. Everybody knows these anime from Japan that have been sweeping American, or at least youth culture. Anime music videos, people take these anime and they re-edit them and set them to music. I'm gonna give you two quick clips of this. So sound should be up here. A little more familiar. I think you need your well, there's sound here. There should be sound here. Phenomena. Okay, so you could, these are creators or recreators, literally tens of thousands of these kids spread across the network in these communities of non-commercial re-creativity, right? And this is, we could call a kind of remix. Not just AMVs, this is this fantastic group of kids, Chocolate Cake City, remixing trailers. I'll give you a couple seconds of this. Okay, and then maybe most important, in context of politics, so maybe two quick clips. Real sound problems. So we have sound here, right?
Do you ever get the feeling you are living in a virtual reality dream world, fabricated to enslave your mind?
A live all-war edition of American Juniors.
But there is another sound, the sound of goodwill.
Oh, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I'm far away in a remote place, and we get these things set up.
My favorite.
My love, there's only you in my life, the only thing that's bright.
My first love. You're every breath that I take. You're every step I make.
And I want to share all my love with you. No one else.
Okay, and one last example. People get really touchy about this one. So, you know, brace yourself. The thing to remember is the theme song is I Will Survive, and he does survive, so don't worry about it. He survives. There's a sequel, and he actually survives, so don't worry about that. Okay, so this is digital creativity. This is what we can think of as the read-write culture that the internet is producing. The critical thing here is not the technique, I think, as you've described. The critical thing is the technique has been democratized. It's now anybody with access to digital technologies can use these technologies to speak differently in ways that the hit makers would never have done. So the tools of creativity here now become tools of speech, new potential to speak. It's a new potential to learn. It's a kind of literacy in the 21st century, right? So that's read-write culture. Now, the question that I want to use this frame, nice slide down to frame as we go forward, is what's the relationship between the long tail to each of these two? Right. So let's start with read-only.
Yeah.
That seems pure long tail story.
Right.
It's all about new ways to perfect this market for distributing all sorts of culture, right?
So that's the new consumer, right? The new consumer is dual consumer. It's a kind of a one-way street, as it were, but they're pulling from a much larger menu. Their minority interests can be satisfied because they can tap anything. They don't have to settle for the one-size-fits-all culture. So most of the examples I've described are very much within the read-only world, which, by the way, is still an incredibly liberated, much richer, more diverse culture, thanks to the long tail. But you're right, that's only one side of the
okay.
equation.
So read-only is a plain long-tail story. Then what I'm puzzled about is the relationship to read-write. Okay, because you spent a lot of time talking about, for example, Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And YouTube is in it, at least some part of YouTube is about this type of creativity. But in what sense is the long tail helping this read-write? Now, YouTube's the one good example here because
right.
it's a bigger market, so there's more people to play with it. But what is the long tail's relationship to Wikipedia?
Well, you know, you have an audience. So, you know, having the tools of production in your hands is theoretically interesting that you can express yourself, but I mean, fundamentally, we're all here to be appreciated, right? So, you know, to go from the theoretical ability to create music and videos and written material to one where you can actually attract an audience as well, and that is due to the democratization of distribution, those filters that I described, the Google and everything else to drive demand down the tail, I think turns it from a sort of a potential read-write culture into a truly viable one because the audience has shifted along with the tools of production.
Okay, but the communities that are producing stuff in the read-write side, again, think about
right.
Wikipedia.
Right.
I think they'd feel they weren't quite understood if it made it sound like they were just doing the same sort of stuff that was happening at the head, but just at the tail. Or that they were doing, a couple times you described the relationship between the head and the tail by saying the head is people who are doing it for commercial purposes and the tail are people who are doing it not for commercial purposes. But these are just radically different economies, right? The commercial economy that typically drove the head and drives lots in the read-only culture is a traditional commercial economy.
Right.
But a lot of the stuff in the read-write space is what you know many people call a sharing economy
right.
or an amateur economy, but that has a different logic to it or a different architecture to it, right?
It does. I mean, you know, I in the book I talk about the sort of reputation economy,
right.
and some people talk about the attention economy. And so there's clearly a currency out there that's motivating people to create that isn't money. So, you know, as I said, you know, all those authors who write for 500 readers are not doing it for money, but also bloggers are not doing it for money, most of them. So we're realizing that people can be motivated by something other than cold, hard cash. And, you know, those motivations include expression, reputation, fun, you know, things like that. I use the word economy quite loosely because obviously economics is not the theory of everything. It's a theory of choice under scarcity. And do we have, you know, scarce reputation? Do we have scarce attention? It's not quite clear. I mean, obviously there are some scarcity factors. So I think it's a really interesting subject to say, can you think of attention and reputation as an economic, you know, phenomena? And can you, in a sense, think of these sort of parallel economies, but where we now have two ways to stimulate production, not just one?
That's right. So I think it's useful to think of it as an economy.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, there's so many words for it. I'll just call it the second economy. This economy that's producing huge value, not for commercial purposes.
Right.
So Wikipedia is one. You talk about the amateur astronomers
mm-hmm.
who actually are now maybe the most significant force in astronomy because of the work they do to collect data about this. There's a wonderful Mars click mapping program where they had to map the craters on Mars. This is a wonderful story told by Yochai Benkler in his book. And they had professionals doing it, and it was very expensive and slow. So then they created this website where people could download images and had a little bit of a training, and then amateurs would map the craters. Mm-hmm. And the amateur mapping process was more accurate than the professionals who would map this, and it was, of course, something produced voluntarily by people all across the world. So this becomes a huge resource for society, and then it becomes a really important question. How do we call it into life? What do we do to make it happen? What can we do to inspire it to occur? And the first important point is, whatever we do, it's probably different from the logic of traditional commercial marketplace.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, one of the artifacts or one of the consequences of hit-driven culture is that it's only commercial culture. And that was the only way that things got out there was via these commercial vehicles that owned this or have monopoly access to the channels of distribution. What we're finding is that you know, now, of course, you have, you know, amateurs have equal access to the channels of distribution. Clearly, the first thing you need to do is give them the tools. So the democratization of tools, and you know, it started with the PC. Obviously, you know, democratized maybe desktop publishing. You know, initially, you know, today every laptop has virtually the entire music industry in it. You can record, mix, distribute, and market music on a laptop. You're close to be able to doing the same thing with video. You've long been able to do the same things with text. So you know, putting the tools in the hands of individuals, you suddenly realize that we've assumed that we'd identified all the talent. We assumed we'd made a pretty good guess at what people wanted. We were totally wrong. The vast majority of the talent was not identified by the traditional machine. The vast majority of kinds of genres of content, this kind of stuff, it would have never been released by, I'm not sure what industry would have never released it, but none of them, all of them would have never released it. And this is exactly what Barry Diller is talking about, 18 million people creating things that they think will have appeal, the emphasis being on they. You know, we didn't get a chance to decide what got out there before. I realize I'm in an awkward position that I sit in both seats. I'm a Condé Nast editor. I'm a classic Barry Diller hit maker. I guess at what's going to be appeal. I try to make blockbusters, and I limit access to my channel. I'm also a blogger, and I'm out there in the tail, much far below you in the tail. I love being able to turn that around. And competing with a zillion other bloggers out there. So, you know, as a consumer of media, I didn't get to decide what got out there. Now, as a producer of media, I do get to decide what gets out there because I can do it myself.
Right. So then, if you think about the businesses on the one side and this amateur or second economy on the other side, then the really challenging project is to figure businesses that mix the two, and there are. I mean, so think about Red Hat, for example, which is a business that commercializes Linux software and commercializes it in a way that, obviously, they want to make tons of money for their stockholders, but they have to make sure that in the process of doing that, they don't poison the well of developers who are actually working very hard to make the software, the GNU Linux system, better, right? The same thing is, you know, happening, obviously, in lots of these contexts that you're talking about. Think about YouTube. Yeah. YouTube is facing lots of really difficult decisions about how it will develop because it doesn't want to turn off its user base, right? And if MySpace hit this issue, YouTube had averted it. But, you know, when they try to claim ownership of all of the creativity for themselves, the user base says, to hell with you. We're not going to be sharecroppers for these big companies. So they have to figure out how to be hybrid in their economy, encourage this new economy, while also being able to be commercial. And that turns out, I think, to be the hardest problem here.
Exactly. I mean, YouTube's a fascinating example. So this, you know, in my book, I use Google Video as an example because I wrote the book middle of last year, and YouTube just hadn't emerged. And over the last 12 months, to see a network-sized, user-generated viral video phenomenon just pop out of nowhere is amazing. So what's interesting about YouTube is that they are currently valuing themselves at more than a billion dollars. So all this free stuff aggregated creates this huge bit of value. The problem is that if they actually try to extract the value from that, they're going to have to do something like putting ads on YouTube. And you know, once upon a time, it was like, you know, we control the vertical, we control the horizontal, we'll put ads where we want. That would be the television model. The new model is that they're terrified of what would happen if they put, you know, one ad out there, because the power has inverted. The power used to be with the sort of the big companies, and the power is now entirely with the mob, you know, with the army of amateurs out there. And if YouTube screws it up, if YouTube gets that balance slightly wrong, there are dozens of other video sites, and they will just scatter.
Right.
So that YouTube doesn't control the audience. The audience controls the content, and they will take it where the environment is most, right. is most fertile.
Okay, so I want to talk about one more thing, and then we're going to have time for some questions. Of course, one issue that you touch on a bunch of times, and it made me very happy that you did, was the relationship between all of this and IP rights, intellectual property rights. So we can again think about the difference between read-only and read-write in this context. So we have fairly rigorous, to be generous, I think of it as extreme, but we have a rigorous system of IP, which creates opportunities and problems. Right? So it creates opportunities in the read-only space because mm-hmm. it gives the companies all the legal power they need to control the perfect distribution of the content which they're now able to market because right. of these new technologies. But you also describe the way in which the current IP regime hurts a lot of stuff in the read-only context. So moving stuff to DVD, for example, becomes almost impossible because it's impossible to go back and clear rights. You have a great story of
KRP in Cincinnati.
KRP in Cincinnati.
Right. This is the sort of the hardest television show on the planet to put on a DVD because it was a sitcom set in a radio station. And in the 70s, I believe. And in the background, there are all these pop songs from the time playing. And so to release it on DVD would require clearing dozens and dozens of songs for each show. And the cost and bureaucracy of doing that is impossible. So until we can find a way to batch clear the rights to old content, a lot of it's going to get locked up in the archives.
Right. And also in the context of film, you say 6,000 films are shown at Sundance every year. A couple dozen might get distribution. A dozen might get distribution.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest reasons for the fact that you can't get access to the rest of them is the high cost of clearing rights for the music and the
yeah.
films.
There's the famous story. There's a movie called Tarnation, which was a documentary a guy did about his mother, and was famously made for $218. What you never hear about it is what it cost to actually clear those rights and distribute it. It was more than $250,000.
It was $400,000.
$400,000,
yeah.
Which is technically more than $250,000. $400,000 to clear the rights to the music he had on his home-generated video. Now, he cleared that hurdle, but most people can't.
Right, okay. So that's the way in which the IP kind of might make the read-only part not work as
right.
well, but still it's supporting the read-only part. But then let's think about the IP on the read-write side.
Yeah.
Right. So here you have all these millions of creators who want to take Lionel Richie's song and use it very powerfully to criticize the president and Tony Blair, or want to take I Will Survive and use it to make some funny point about religion. In that context, the IP system is really just holding back this kind
Absolutely.
Of creative, right?
It's really messy. I refer to rights as being this sort of the elephant in the room of the long tail. It is the single biggest barrier to unlocking both the commercial value and the cultural value in getting access to these kind of things. There's a paradox actually where you and I probably end up with a little tension, which is that so. We've been talking about the long tail of variety. So you have broad appeal at one end and narrow appeal at the other. There's another long tail. That's the long tail of time. There's the new stuff and the old stuff. And not only do some things not get on the shelf in the first place, but things fall off the shelf as the sales decline over time. And then they fall into the archives, and then they're gone. They're just not available. Television is an extraordinary example where almost all of television is not available for you to see because it was broadcast in that brief window of commercial viability and then, for all intents and purposes, vaporized. So what I'm saying is that we're now measuring, in music in particular, in places where you can get archives out, that the demand for old stuff is much larger than we thought. And so we're now realizing that this stuff, our cultural history locked up in archives, has huge commercial value. Now, the IP consequence of that would be that, hey, maybe Disney's not wrong. Maybe we should extend copyright further and further into time because this assumption that one of the cases that you
Paul,
make...
Paul, you wanted to fight, so we're about to have it right now.
Yeah. This is the point where he lunges at me. You know, Larry, one of Larry's arguments, and by the way, I'm on his side on this one. I'm just pointing out a sort of a logical problem in this. You know, one of Larry's arguments is that most commercial value of content is realized in a very short period of time, months or years or something like that, and that we lock it up and withhold it from the rest of culture for marginal additional cost. The long tail time says, in fact, that might not be marginal additional value. That in fact, maybe that content does have commercial value for decades.
Yeah. Well, your book was published by Disney, but you're not using long tail logic to analyze this problem sufficiently, because you're right, it might turn out that it's more valuable, but the percentage of this old stuff that has real commercial value is tiny,
right?
Maybe 2% of the stuff in the copyright term extension had any commercial value. The rest of it has no commercial value, but if you are an archive and you want to make it accessible, and you've got to clear all these rights, then it's impossible to get access to this material. So the last debate we had here about Google Books, Google wants to scan 18 million books. Of those 18 million books, 16% are in the public domain. 9% are in print and under copyright. 75% are out of print but still under copyright. If the law says Google has to get permission from 75% of the 18 million in order to scan them, which is the position of the publishers, then those 75% will just simply not be in the archive, because there's no way to identify the copyright holders to get permission for it. So the point is, if you really think about the long tail of use for all of this old material, then having all those rights really makes it impossible to make this.
I think it's a way to reconcile these two positions. And at this point, I'm going to steal your ideas and claim them as my own. Here's my two ideas. The first is that you have to opt in. The 1 cent renewal.
Thank
you. That your copyright does not automatically extend forever, but you have to ask for it to be extended. And of course, if there is commercial value, then all someone has to do is pay their penny and they get it extended. But most people probably won't, either because they don't care or because there is no commercial value. So that would help the older stuff, the much older stuff. The other bit would be to make it easier to clear rights. The problem with clearing rights is partly that it's expensive and more that it's incredibly complicated. I mean, sometimes the holders of these rights, they're dead, and you have to deal with their estates. Sometimes you can't find who owns the rights. And if there was a way to sort of, you know, batch clear rights, a clearinghouse, as it were, that sort of says, you know, all self-service, can I have these rights? Yes. Here's the price, $5, done. That, I think, would lower the barrier to entry, and you would see more of the stuff coming out.
Yeah, but then again, in the read-write space, for those kids, if there's ever going to be somebody who gets to make the judgment whether you get the right to use it or not, it's going to be very hard for the kind of diversity that you celebrate here.
Do we really have a problem here? YouTube is full of exactly what you describe. Mm-hmm. It's happening. I mean, we are not seeing the owners of I Will Survive going out and suing these kids. Now, there are occasional examples. I use that example
for a very particular purpose. I showed that video at a Hollywood event. The very next day, Universal sent a notice and takedown to the author for that.
Stop showing the videos.
And Universal has been famously saying that, you know, we know what we do with companies like this, quote unquote.
Right.
And, you know, so you're right this moment looks like it's all going to be great. But there was a moment during the Napster history, too, where it looked like it was all going to be great, and that fell pretty quickly.
I think you're right. And, you know, first of all, two things. We're talking here what's called synchronization rights. This is where you put music behind something else. And, you know, we all do it on our home videos. We put music behind it. I mean, technically, it's illegal. Every time we sing Happy Birthday, technically, we should be paying rights. We don't. And I think we'll probably continue getting away with the synchronization stuff. There's just so much of it out there, it's just not worth suing. The other one might be on the video itself. You know, YouTube, again, is also full of videos TiVo'd and ripped and distributing. And the television industry, as we'll talk about tomorrow at that panel with MTV and NBC, etc., television industry is completely conflicted about this. The marketers say 10 minutes from the Colbert Report is fantastic marketing for the Colbert Report. Let it go. And the other half of the business that has to deal with the business side, with the affiliates, with the contracts, with the Screen Actors Guild saying, you know, this is the slippery slope. If we let it go out there, we're not only in contractual violation, but we're going to get sued. You know, you're risking the company. And I don't know how this is going to sort out. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the business side, the first side, ought to win, and the lawyers ought to be locked in a room and just not permitted to control the future of culture. That's my view. But I'm a lawyer. We're going to now take questions. And I think there are mics at both sides of the auditorium. So you should go and line up behind the mics, and we'll take the... So first on my left, right here.
Great. I have a question. If you could discuss in this new world of accessibility of content and in consideration of social networking and peer-to-peer marketing, what the role of tastemakers and media, is it going to be diminished or increased? Are people going to want a DJ, or are they going to just figure it out from their friends?
Well, you know, we tastemakers have a lot of competition now, is the answer. You know, the tastemakers, what we're seeing is an extraordinary shift of attention from institutions to individuals. So the old tastemakers are, you know, we who decide what gets out there, the professional, you know, studio bosses, the editors, the critics, etc. The new tastemakers are people just like you. They are the powerful blogs, they are the Amazon reviewers, they are individuals. And I think it's really quite a challenge for all of us, in the sort of traditional hit-driven industry, is that we're now watching people trust us as institutions less, and trust those other individuals like them, the peers, more. And so we have a challenge to sort of engage in that conversation. We have to speak in more authentic voices. We have to, you know, we have to maybe give them, you know, we have to let them blog on our sites, and you know, we have to enable peer production wherever it can. I mean, it's very tricky. We haven't figured it out yet, but. That is the world we're entering.
That's right. Dave?
Hi. Ed Whitaker of AT&T wants to take a big fat toll off any video going to any AT&T DSL customer, and Time Warner just said the same thing. Inspired by the end-to-end principle, but really about the long tail, what do you think will happen to the long tail and minority culture if that fee is part of the cost of distributing video?
Did you set him up?
I should have.
This was inspired, obviously, by End to End and half a dozen books by Larry.
This is where we really have an argument. Yeah.
This is where Larry and I disagree a little bit. So I have a very unpopular view. You're talking about net neutrality. This whole notion that sort of the, you know, the man.
Don't use a word like net neutrality that the lobbyists make up. Say whether Ed Whitaker at AT&T
We're talking about the hypothetical possibility that the least competent companies in America might control this extraordinarily diverse and heterogeneous network called the Internet. If that were to happen, that would totally suck, and we should definitely do something about it. But I think it won't happen. I think that this is a very robust network. I think that heterogeneity wins. And I think we should wait for markets to fail before we create legislation that could create a much worse problem by mistake. So Larry disagrees.
Yeah, so Chris is wrong about that.
Yeah.
And the reason he's wrong is that it's again a kind of long tail point. The reason he's wrong is that people look forward to the network. And if Ed Whitaker's of the world are right, that network will be a network where a relatively small number of companies are the gatekeepers. So your whole point about the long tail was how the gatekeepers were broken open. And at least on the margin, the cost of access is a function of the gatekeepers. And in that world, right now, there are innovators who are thinking, does it make sense for me to innovate in a world where there will be those gatekeepers versus not?
Right.
And on the margin, fewer will be innovating in that world. So I would think the question ought to be, what good reason is there for us to give up this network that inspired the long tail to take off?
Right.
And go to a network where there will be people who have the power to say, shut down these people who are not allied with us.
I agree. If this were to happen, that would suck. And you are speculating that there are companies who are not investing because they think it might happen. And that may or may not be true. I know of no examples. Okay, cards on the table. I'm a little bit of a libertarian. I think that we should have the Hippocratic Oath of legislation, which is, you know, first do no harm. And I'm so worried about the unintended consequences of getting this legislation wrong that I'm willing to take the chance that, you know, the tiny chance that they might in fact screw things up.
Yeah, well, if the networks had the same principle, do no harm, then I'd be on your side. But I don't think that's their principle. On this side.
I've noticed that you've used a lot the words democratizing and grassroots. Does the idea of the long tail versus the head translate into politics, where the gatekeepers are Democrats and Republicans and the grassroots?
Yeah.
Do you think that it will have an effect on the two-party system in America? Or
great question. I wish I had a better answer for you. So clearly, you know, two parties does not represent the fullness of diversity of political opinion in America, or in any country. We are obviously much more diverse than our political system recognizes. It is a reflection of scarcity. It's a distortion. It's a bottleneck in measuring opinion and measuring votes. And because we have an inefficient way of doing both informing the populace and engaging their opinion, we end up with this representative system, which leads to this sort of, you know, shrinking of choice down to two parties. I think that we have some help on our, you know, coming. I think it's clearly more easy to educate populations about political issues. And, you know, I'm not sure that Diebold is our friend on this side, but technically it could be more easier to measure votes, to take votes in ways that don't require people to line up in a garage or the fire station. What I'm talking about is direct democracy. You know, voting not necessarily for political parties, but voting on individual issues. In California, we've tried this, and we continue to try this, voting on individual, you know, ballot initiatives. One of those ballot initiatives brought Arnold Schwarzenegger into power.
And you're for all this right now, you're saying.
Well, I think it's a great experiment. If it works, I mean, obviously it's very, you know, you can have mob rule. I mean, democracy. You know, there are the three most powerful forces in our world today, democracy, capitalism, and evolution, are freakish. They're totally counterintuitive. We're still fighting about all three of those. I think on balance, democracy is good and more democracy is better. I realize that there are parts of this world right now that are proving a very strong counterexample to that. And I'd like it to be true, but I can't prove that it is.
But it is plainly the case that the long tail is changing who can control the message. So the parties, even though they're still just two parties, have lost the ability to really control the way the message develops in the way that 30 years ago.
I agree entirely. I think you're going to see the rise of independents. I think that Bloomberg and Schwarzenegger represent independents who sort of nominally joined one party or the other, but they're really independents. Perot did, what, 16%, you know, before the internet? What would a really powerful independent candidate do, you know, for president, what could they do today? I think we will actually find out.
Right here.
You mentioned that YouTube has no business model. And if they picked one, they might pick the wrong one and then get diluted. So it seems like the other elephant in the room when talking about the long tail is maybe it's time for micropayments. And, you know, that would be like the solution. You'd have distributed payments and people distributed benefactors with literally no middleman.
The standing policy of my career is it's never time for micropayments. my entire career has been you know, sort of example after example, effort after effort to make this work, and people hate being nickel and dimed.
You think the attention economy will just like always be there?
Well, we do have a currency right now that's micropayment. It is attention. It is reputation. We pay, you know, with our clicks. I think people hate paying with real money. I think they hate the meter ticking. You know, I could be wrong. What do you think?
No, I think you're exactly right. But it's really important to recognize that in some of the most vibrant of these communities, it's not just that micropayments wouldn't work. They would poison the community, right? If you went into Wikipedia and said, I have a great new idea. What we'll do is we'll give people micropayments whenever they edit work. That would change what it means to be a member of Wikipedia. You'd no longer be doing this as a great kind of act of volunteerism. You would be doing it because you're trying to rack up micropayments, right? So the point is this assumption that the model of commerce is a model we ought to be imposing on every one of these communities is, I think, what we're learning is wrong, right? And we're learning that there are very powerful, valuable communities that right. don't fit that model, and we ought to respect them and encourage them.
Precisely.
Right there.
The long tail had an earlier name called Zipf's Law, and it's a remarkable pattern, as you indicate in your book and your blogs, that appears in the most amazing range of phenomena. Zipf was a Harvard linguist, and he claimed that the pattern that you see is the result of people basically trying to minimize effort.
Yeah.
That is the principle of least effort, he called it. And I'd like to ask you what you think, if he is correct, how, if people do take the easy route whenever it's offered, how this will affect whether or not people in reality go down the long tail, if it involves more effort than basically the easy route, which is following the crowd.
Interesting. But let me explain a little bit more for those of you who may not be familiar with Zipf's Law. Zipf's Law found that, I think it actually used James Joyce's Ulysses, found that the word frequency of James Joyce's Ulysses distributed as a power law. So the was the most popular word, then an, et cetera, right down to some obscure word. It was a weird power law. And the theory they came up with was actually two ones, that the short words obviously get used the most, and also that words are combined in pairs, and that this linkage between them is a form of network effects that gave a premium to certain words and not to others. So paired words were more frequently found than non-paired words. It turns out that Zipf may have been wrong about that. If you go to my blog, you'll see a lot of talk about this. But one of the most interesting fields of research right now is understanding power laws. Why do power laws occur? Because this notion, as you say, they're completely ubiquitous. They show up in earthquakes. Earthquakes distribute a power law. A small number of big...
linguist, a Harvard linguist, and he claimed that the pattern that you see is the result of people basically trying to minimize effort.
Yeah.
That is the principle of least effort, he called it. And I'd like to ask you what you think, if he is correct,
yeah.
How, if people do take the easy route whenever it's offered, how this will affect whether or not people in reality go down the long tail, if it involves more effort than basically the easy route, which is following the crowd.
Interesting. But let me explain a little bit more for those of you who may not be familiar with Zipf's Law. Zipf's Law found that, I think it actually used James Joyce's Ulysses, found that the word frequency of James Joyce's Ulysses distributed as a power law. So the was the most popular word, then an, et cetera, right down to some obscure word. It was a weird power law. And the theory they came up with was actually two ones, that the short words obviously get used the most, and also that words are combined in pairs, and that this linkage between them is a form of network effects that gave a premium to certain words and not to others. So paired words were more frequently found than non-paired words. It turns out that Zipf may have been wrong about that. If you go to my blog, you'll see a lot of talk about this. But one of the most interesting fields of research right now is understanding power laws. Why do power laws occur? Because this notion, as you say, they're completely ubiquitous. They show up in earthquakes. Earthquakes distribute a power law. A small number of big earthquakes, a large number of small ones. Cities, a small number of New Yorks, a large number of smaller cities. Biological species, scientific papers, they all appear to distribute this weird power laws. It's weirdly ubiquitous. The theory is that it's due to network effects, which is that network effects are basically things like word of mouth, where you get the snowball effect. The popularity begets more popularity, the rich get richer, and this leads to this sort of acceleration where some things get all the benefits and then everything else gets very little. As I say, it's a really thriving area of research. It goes into complexity theory. I'm doing my best to try to understand it and blog about it. The reason I have a blog is so that I can stop talking and you guys can go read it.
Over here.
George Santayana once said that it doesn't matter what college students read as long as they all read the same thing. And in fact, in the 19th century, they did read the same thing much more than in the 20th century. You use the word balkanization as if it was good, and in fact, the Balkans were a relatively unpleasant place to live, both when that work was coined and in the 1990s. Do you think that a certain amount of head of the tail is needed for social cohesion?
That's a great question. This is actually a question I address in a chapter in the book. This is the notion that common culture defines us, and that mass culture, the fact that we are in cultural lockstep, and we were all watching I Love Lucy at the same time, was in a sense the linkage that kept us together as a nation, as a people. And clearly we're losing that. We're not all watching the same things, and those cultural linkages are fraying. And the question is, are we going to be sort of less well-defined as Americans, as people of our generation, because of this? And I think there is going to be some loss of common culture, some loss of collective national culture. But the point I make in the book, and you can tell me whether you're persuaded, is that those mass culture, one-size-fits-all, pop linkages are relatively superficial connections. And the fact that you and I watched CSI last night is maybe the start of a conversation, but doesn't go very far. And what we're moving to is tribal culture. These are tribes of affinity. The fact that you and I are skydivers, I'm not, you may be, But if we were, that would be a very deep connection. That is a real relationship. And so in a sense, what we're losing in loose connections with everybody, we're gaining in very tight connections with smaller groups of people. And fortunately, there's lots of them. You have lots of interests, I have lots of interests, and all these parallel tribes, what I call massively parallel culture, I think is where we're going, and I suspect we will be tighter for it, but not in the same way we were through broadcast television.
Over here.
Quick comment for you, Mr. Lessig, is that I saw a keynote of yours a couple of years ago and it changed my life, so thanks for that.
for the better, I hope, right?
Oh, much, yeah, much good. Better. I wanna be a lawyer now.
Wrong lesson.
My question is, with the rise of DMR, DRM, rather, do you see read-only culture becoming less available for writing and remixing? And how do you think that will affect read-write culture? Will it take away from legitimacy? And how can open source DRM maybe combat this?
Well, right. So digital rights management are the sort of software equivalent of the laws of copyright. And they are, and will be, I've been a doomsayer about this for a long time now, will be much more effective at controlling what people do with content than laws ever are, right? So people remix stuff on YouTube all the time without worrying about the laws. But when DRM is in there, you know, only the hackers will be able to remix it because they'll have to crack the code to be able to do it. And so I do think that the widespread of DRM will fundamentally weaken the opportunity of the read-write to take off. This is why business models that figure out how to encourage people to make content available and allow this kind of non-commercial remixing are really important, the hybrid economy stuff. So we've talked about YouTube. Another great example, I think, is a company called Rever. This kind of goes against my micropayments point, but what Rever does is add a little ad bug at the end of a video. And that ad bug gets played, and the person who plays the person who made the video then gets paid. And unlike YouTube, Rever wants people to distribute videos all across the net virally. Like, they don't want to control it in one space. So that's more consistent with the values of the original internet. Authors get paid lots because of this. The one very famous example is one of seen the Diet Coke and Mentos video. They got $25,000 in 1 week for those video producers because of this particular model. Now, the point is, this model is hybrid. There's commercial side. There's also a kind of people are just creating stuff and putting it out there. It also encourages people to be more open about the content that would be available because there's actually some kind of market opportunity here. And I think if we see more ideas like that, it'll put pressure on what I think of as the dark story about how DRM kills off the read-write culture.
Building on that man's question about the balkanization, can you envision a kind of backlash against this, and we realize some kind of fundamental social desire for the blockbuster, and we no longer have this kind of passive style of blockbuster, which is a kind of top-down model, but a more grassroots blockbuster, if that's not an oxymoron, yeah. But, you know, something that builds enough, gets the kind of percentages, but in a different way.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think I described the sort of the rise of the viral videos as the grassroots bottoms-up hits. And I think you're absolutely, in culture, you're going to see more hits than ever, but they are exactly, you're going to be sort of successes from the meritocracy, from the marketplace of opinion rather than the top-down ones. You asked about a backlash, and I think there is one possible backlash, which is very much in politics. Right now, we used to have a political discourse mediated by the New York Times, which was an even-handed, you know, relatively balanced place that tried to have all the news fit to print, whether it achieved that or not. We now have a political discourse moving online. We have extraordinarily polarized, angry, you know, the left is further left, the right is further right, never the twain shall meet. And, you know, you could argue that at this moment, the political discourse is degraded because of a diversity of voices. Now, I actually don't think that's true, but you could argue that. I suspect that this very angry political discourse happening out there in the blogosphere is a kind of a first day phenomena that we're drawn to fresh voices, we're drawn to new voices, and we now can get them. And I think we're going out there and we're sort of celebrating these passionate voices on either side.
over time, we may become tired or may realize that's not the whole picture. We may read lots more blogs and try to achieve balance, not with any single source, but by sort of picking the multiple points of view that together combine to a more balanced view. That's my hope. That's what's going to happen to the political blogosphere. Larry, do you think that's going
to happen? Well, I think that the really important difference is not that the quality of political discourse is better or the criticism is not that it's worse. The really important difference is now there are 50 million people engaging in the process of arguing in a public way about political issues, and 25 years ago, they weren't. They were sitting there consuming political messages fed to them by somebody else. That's the shift from read-only to read-write in this context. Now, the first part of the question, though, this drive for some kind of hits, I really do agree with what Chris's analysis of this is. We will still have this very strong drive for hits. But we want to be cool enough to get the cues of the hit no longer from what NBC executives think, but from the 20 cool people we know really know something about what we should be thinking of as the hit. So we have this innate desire to you know, come together in some sense about certain issues. It's just who's signaling those hits that is the really important change.
Exactly. We can measure popularity rather than trying to predict it. Guesswork. Yeah.
If that's the case, then what's going to happen to the established media industry, the music industry, the movie industry? Are they going to play a role in this, or do you see both of those industries as just crashing down?
Well, that's the challenge. Do we have time for one? Okay, we'll take one more question after this. So we actually have a long track record. So if you look at it in terms of which industries fall first, it goes on file size. So text is a very, very, very small file size, and you know, dial-up modems and the web were the first to sort of, you know, challenge us in the mainstream, you know, print media. So we've been dealing with competition, long-tail competition, for over a decade now. Music is the next smallest file size, and it was sort of around 2000 with a combination of broadband and the MP3 and the file trading services, and the music industry then had to deal with that. And we now see what they're doing, and I'll talk about that in a second. And now, right now with YouTube, it's television's turn. That three-minute video is now, you know, at the size and the network sort of the power that we can now actually see real competition for the first time. I think the music industry is a perfect example of how you deal with this. I mean, they basically imploded for a while. I mean, sales were down, they just didn't know what they were doing, and now they're realizing that they're going to have to change. The denial phase is over, and they're now in the sort of adaptation phase. And what you're seeing is that rather than signing 10 artists and giving them all $10 million each, they're developing digital-only labels where they can sign maybe 100 artists, give them very little money because they don't need very much money, and distribute them just not in Walmart, try to kind of buy their way onto the shelf, and that is, by the way, how you get onto the shelf, buy their way onto the shelf of Walmart. Instead, they're going to distribute them digitally where the audience for that music is likely to find. So what's the value that given that I said that the entire tools of the music industry are in your laptop, why do you need to deal with a label at all? And the answer is that there is a certain amount of credibility that comes with having a label name. Now, is it worth signing away 90% of your royalties? No. So they have to do much more favorable deals. It's much more equitable, you know, contract. And that if the music does do well and you are signed to that label, then they can take you into Walmart. They can, you know, they have the ability to go that extra step and reach the broader audience out there in the bricks and mortar world. So I think that's a kind of a positive lesson that the music industry is finally adapting to a long tail world. And I suspect television is going to be going there in the next few years as well. And so we'll take, do we have time
one more
for
more? Question?
Yeah.
Thank you. As a husband and father and a provider for a family, I really want to congratulate you on the success of your book. I'm also a user and huge respecter of Creative Commons. Thank you for everything you've done, Mr. Lessig, on that. So I have to ask, basically for a year and a half, I've followed along on your blog and watched the intellectual journey to this concept and this body of knowledge for the long tail. The coup de grace is a paper book. You, more than anybody out there, understand all the problems that come along with that. So my question is, have we reached a point where the paper book is actually a tool used to restrict the flow of information? It's actually a new form of DRM.
Wow. That's a good last question.
Looks like we're out of time. Thank you very much.
So, I see my publisher has now left, so I can answer. I believe in books.
I think books are the right way to read. I think paper is the right way to read a book. I do not want to read 150,000, no, actually it's only 80,000 words on an electronic form. I don't happen to like ebook formats, even with a Sony e-reader. I think books are the right form for that kind of content. However, one size doesn't fit all. So for the book, that was paper. But I also realized there's plenty of my ideas, my geeky, you know, power law discussion, et cetera, that didn't fit into one size fits all model. It was too geeky for some of the audience. There's all sorts of industries that I didn't include. You know, beer, agriculture, things that you know, are great long tail examples that didn't fit in the one size fits all model. So fortunately, I have a blog. So the long tail of the long tail is on the blog. The short head of the long tail is the book. And that's
and
my
plan. And the long tail on the blog is licensed under a Creative Commons license.
Exactly. And by the way, we also give away four free chapters. And if it were up to me, I would give away the whole book online because I think that, thank you. Because I want to maximize my readership. And the way to maximize the readership is to give it to people in whatever form they want it. And I will find a way to make money off charging you guys even more to come in here or other things. But I want to have an impact, and the way you have an impact is that you make things available in the easiest way and the cheapest way for everybody.
Chris, I'm really relieved to know that books are still important.
Yes.
But particularly since we're at the New York Public Library, it's a great source of relief for me. So if you want to get a book rather than a blog from Chris Anderson, he will be signing his book rather than his blog right after this event. And I would like to thank Lawrence Lessig and Chris Anderson for goading each other.